Who's hosting?
You.
No, I did it last time.
You're the host with the most.
I did it last time.
It's your You're the now. Host.
You're Aww. The host.
Yeah. Oh, I can do it.
You can do it.
If need be, I'll do it.
Yeah, I did
I
it
do
last
next time.
Time. Good.
All right.
Okay.
No. So, welcome to another brand new... Start again.
To a brand new start again in 2021. No.
So, welcome to a brand new episode of the 21 CB thing, and it's 2021. Yes, it's a new year. So, what's going on today? What are we doing? We've got some more quotes.
Some more quotes.
Yeah.
Quotes.
Who wants to go first? That's my hosting, I'm afraid. That's my style. I told you I'm not a good host. It doesn't matter.
Good, okay.
Who's first? What's going on?
I'll start then.
Yeah.
I'm going to take over.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Well, you just heard Tara Palata. We're here with Dhammasara and Singaravi.
Oh, yeah. That's what you're supposed to say when you host something.
That's what you're supposed to say.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Yep.
Hello.
Yeah.
Great to see you.
Happy New Year. Hopefully this year will be better. Good news.
All
fresh
of that
start.
Stuff. Yeah, carry on.
Good.
Yeah, that stuff. Yeah.
And well, actually, I brought a quote that is a classic.
Oh,
it's a classic, but I love it because I don't really understand it. And it's the mindfulness quote that everyone knows, quite basic Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And it goes like that: mindfulness is the way to the immortal. Unmindfulness, the way to death. Mm-hmm. Those who are mindful do not die, whereas the unmindful are like the dead.
Do you want to read that again?
Mindfulness is the way to the immortal. Unmindfulness, the way to death. Those who are mindful do not die, whereas the unmindful are like the dead.
Oof.
Hmm.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Yeah.
No idea.
Yeah, I think when I first heard it, I thought it was like, oh, you know, it's because you're kind of aware of what's happening and, you know, you're not sleepwalking all the time.
Yeah, you could say it like that.
Yeah, but it's a bit, it feels like it's not quite what it means, I think.
No.
I think it's more, I don't know, yeah.
I think
I'm interested to hear what you're thinking.
I mean, I personally think it's saying something that I don't understand, like on a level that I'm not capable of comprehending.
Mm.
I don't think it's mumbo jumbo.
No.
Hmm.
I don't think it's just an analogy that we're all sleepwalking, like the film The Matrix or whatever. Yeah. But I don't know. I don't know.
Hmm.
Let's explore.
Yeah, yeah, maybe look at it line from verse by verse. Maybe that.
Well, the first verse is mindfulness is the way to the immortal. Yeah. So. Mindfulness is the way to the immortal. I mean, that is very interesting because, the immortal, obviously we hear that and we know that from Christianity or something, you know, that I mean, that's usually our connotation when we hear the immortal, the eternal, you know, the undying. That's kind of, you know, that's a kind of eternity aspect. So I was quite confused when I heard that because I thought it wasn't about immortality.
Yeah.
Buddhism wasn't about immortality.
Yeah.
But at the same time, in a different quote, the Buddha, when he gains enlightenment, he says, "Open are the gates to the deathless."
Yeah, the deathless. That's
yeah. Yeah. I think it. As I understand it, it's more the amrita, which I think is the translation as well, which is more not an eternal state, but more a state of bliss, of this kind of nectar of bliss.
Mm. Yeah, amrita. Yeah, that's the literal translation.
Is that the translation?
It's that's Sanskrit.
Amrita, I think.
Pali. I can't remember what the Pali is, but the funny thing is that amrita means both, like, you know, the nectar of the gods, but it also literally means amrita, which means immortal, so non-dead.
Wow.
So the deathless is, you know, the amrita, you know, I think it's related to the, you know, to the ambrosia, like even etymological.
So in a way it does come across as immortal as well.
Yeah.
It's but it
bliss,
is
but it's immortal.
It is this kind of juice or the kind of the nectar which is a more I find it's a more positive kind of image and it's an image that you find quite a lot in different connotations, like I don't know, I think there are also descriptions of Avalokiteshvara, like streaming forth nectar, or of course Padmasambhava having the nectar in his in the skull cup and all that. So I always connected with that image of.
Yeah, I've always been confused, not confused, but it's just been a giant mystery, that part of the, well, what you just read is, to me, it's been a giant mystery, that whole paragraph. I don't quite know how to approach it, really. Yeah. I mean, because in a way, it's not part, I was going to say, it's not part of kind of classic Buddhist teaching, in a sense of like rebirth, you know, death. There's nothing that's immortal, there's no soul to be immortal.
So, yeah, that's kind of what we learn, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I think we can agree on that the way to the immortal obviously means the way to enlightenment, basically. Yeah. So immortal being enlightenment. And I think it, I was thinking, my first thought was, well, if you look at, you know, what we call the lakshana, so the condition, the marks of existence.
Which are, exactly.
So you have, you know, the Buddha says, well, if you look at reality, then you will find unsatisfactoriness. Mm. So you find that things are not, you know, give you everlasting happiness and bliss. You know, there will be pleasant things, but they won't, because they won't last, which is the second mark, impermanence. Mm. They will go, everything that comes into existence has an end. Mm. So there's nothing immortal in reality. Mm. And then the last one being
insubstantiality.
Yeah, it's quite
very
mouthful.
What's it in German?
Nicht selbst.
Okay.
Non-self.
Non-self.
We should say non-self.
Oh, okay. That's the actual translation.
I mean, you could also say Nichtsubstantialität, but it's a bit weird. No, we wouldn't say that probably. No, non-substantiality.
So that things don't have a fixed core because they, they're conditioned. They come into existence out of other conditions, so there's nothing eternal or nothing, holy, even inside of, you know, everlasting kind of soul in that way. So I think what they're saying is that the Buddha is saying that, you know, people make the mistake in Buddhism that they think Buddhism says everything has those three marks.
Yeah.
You know, even so you just kind of need to believe in that as if those is like a dogma.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we pray, we say, oh, you know, everything's suffering, everything's coming to an end. And that's kind of what we believe in. But actually what he's saying is, no. If you look at your experience, you will find those things. Mm. And because we're usually blocking those three things out, we don't want to see things as impermanent. We don't want to see things as dissatisfactory. So, but there is actually a state that is blissful, that is everlasting, and you could also describe as having a sort of substance or something. Those are the three marks of enlightenment. So we're actually just saying, well, the way we are now, is a bit dissatisfactory.
So the immortal is a word to use for enlightenment in this case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because in that case, the whole thing about stepping off the wheel. So you've got a whole wheel of existence, haven't you? Death and life and death. And even if you keep getting reborn, you still keep dying, according to Buddhism. So it's like you're in the realm of death continuously. Mm. So I'd imagine it's sort of saying that as well, like mindfulness, which isn't just being aware of your body and your breathing. And there's a whole huge, maybe we can talk about that as well, what mindfulness in its fullness actually means. It means you're, according to Buddhism, if you're fully mindful, then you step off the wheel of life and death, really, into some other state that, well, you can't really speculate on, in a sense. You get glimpses of, maybe, but
there's probably a whole thing. I mean, if you look at that, I mean, mindfulness and look at it from the Satipatthana perspective, like looking at mindfulness of your body, mindfulness emotions, mindfulness of your thoughts, and mindfulness of actual reality, then, I mean, that covers quite a lot of ground.
Yeah. Actually. I mean, it's everything.
It's everything in a way, yeah.
And I think that's it, maybe, that in a, not to detract from it, but from kind of secular mindfulness, there's a limit, isn't there? There's a limit, probably, I would imagine, to do your thoughts and emotions. But in terms of reflecting on the nature of reality at depth, that's I don't think that's really part of it in a way.
I think those, you know, what we call the satipatthana, the basis of mindfulness, is something that was quite groundbreaking for me, because you associate mindfulness with like body awareness sometimes and maybe feelings or something, but to sort of have the body,
your feelings, emotions, thoughts, and reality, or dharmas, like reality or as the dharma.
So having phenomena is it. So I love that because when I really go through those, basically I start with the body, then I go to the feelings, then I go to, well, thoughts and emotions are kind of the same thing in Buddhism, aren't they? They lump together in what we call sort of citta, which is heart, mind. And then you're even extending mindfulness to just, you know, the coming and going of phenomena, really.
Well, I mean, that's the point, isn't it? Well, that's the point for Buddhism, isn't it? All the other stuff is kind of... it's a bit crude to say it's preparation, but the whole point is to start feeling into reflecting, you know, at depth on the nature of reality, and then maybe all this sort of stuff happens. You do, because in a way the poetry of it is the kind of point, isn't it? You step into something that you can have a load of words about it, but when you actually do it, then you start having these odd experiences. And I think that's probably why people end up becoming Buddhists. It certainly was for me. It's like you do stuff, and then very odd stuff starts happening, or you expand in a way that you weren't really aware of, and you think, oh, right, there's a whole other side to this.
I think it's that state out of your current imagination that. And I think that's also, for me, in the image of the deathless or the amrita, the nectar, it is something that is beyond my current state of imagination. Whatever it might be, this points me to that zone, I guess.
Maybe that's why that language gets used then, because it's the whole thing. It's like, it's not within your known... If we could all sit here after Dharmasara has read that and go, oh yeah, this relates to this, and this is part of chapter 7 of this book, and then tick, it would be meaningless. It wouldn't be pointing in the right direction, then, would it? It'd just be like an academic conversation.
And it's beyond the world as we know it as well. I mean, it's really... pointing towards a state of being in the transcendental realm, that is not part of the samsaric, the world as we know it, with death and rebirth.
I guess that's the interesting thing about talking about this stuff as well, because you can only fruitfully have this sort of discussion if you're practicing the Dharma somehow, because otherwise it's just a fantastical or an imaginal exercise. Whereas if you're not actually engaged in that mindfulness in terms of meditating and your day-to-day and reflections, it all just becomes fantastical and theoretical, like, oh yeah, well, this is a bit like this religion and this is connected to that. You know, it only stays on one level.
It makes sense
when you actually just get a taste of it yourself. Taste of freedom.
Well, yeah, and it kind of it goes all you know, through all those four ways of experiencing yourself as well. It kind of delves deep into your emotions, into your body.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, these delineations of the four satipatthanas, you know, like the whole body, then thought, feelings, and then hedonic thoughts, tone, whatever, and then thoughts, and then, you know, we divide them all, don't I think Sangharach makes that point in a way. We kind of divide all these things, but they're so that we can sit around and talk about them, but in reality you can't really divide, oh no, here's my body, da, 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 da. Here's the hedonic tone, oh, pleasant, painful, here's the thought and the emotion, and now here's reality. It's the whole thing is working together. It's like one thing and you just... But it's helpful, isn't it, to have...
It's a method to kind of split it apart in order to be able to kind of look at it and learn to distinguish it.
That's what I was going to say when you were saying about the way it's written. I thought, oh, well, it's all method, isn't it? This, what you just read, it's kind of poetry in a way, but there's a reason for that. It's method. It's not like you're sitting here with a hard script, you're like, ah, the immortal and mindful. It's like a method, isn't it, to lead you somewhere so you experience something for yourself.
That's what I thought. I mean, just talking about the immortal and then kind of having that association, that the same word also refers to like a divine nectar or something.
That's
just
quite something.
Obviously it has to be, that sentence or that verse has to be a metaphor. You know, obviously, literally, we don't believe in like a substance somewhere that is kind of going to give us immortality, but it's more because Immortality, obviously, that's something I think that, you know, appears again and again in human cultures, in stories, in myths of all sorts of different cultures. So it's quite a, for some reason, it has a strong pull for us as an image, as a myth. But I think what he means here, obviously, is not literal immortality, because that wouldn't be the answer to the problem of life and death in Buddhism. Yeah. But the answer of life and death in Buddhism is beyond life and death altogether, and that is what he means with immortality.
It's a state of mind that we can't imagine that might be best described with that kind of blissful nectar, something that is fluid and... Yeah, I think it's probably a state of mind that
maybe if you're in that state of mind and you read that, you'd be like,
that's it.
It's like, oh yeah, of course.
Yeah, we're sitting there going, oh, what is it? It's over here, it's over there.
Is it like not dying or not living? Or
I mean, maybe it also has to do with fear as well, because I think one of the big appeals of immortality isn't just having more experience, like endless eternal experience, you know, more drinking, more green tea, doing more this, doing more. It's kind of to do with fear as well, isn't it? So I could imagine that you're in a state of fearlessness, and you, and also that nectar is the whole thing about nectar and bliss. It's got some sensory. You can feel it, can't you? It's kind of like moisture and pleasant, and kind of wow. There's a kind of freedom there as well, isn't there? It's like the horrible pain's kind of gone, and there's a sense of kind of freedom from fear as well. So,
I mean, one thing that always struck me as an image as well was. I mean, this is a bit of an excursus as well, but, you know, in Buddhism, we have these six realms, so six kind of ways of being that you can be reborn in. I mean, again, six is obviously just you know.
No, there is just six realms.
Only six.
Only six, and they're very clearly delineated.
Yeah. Strong borders between them. Yeah. Well, basically, they're states of mind, because the state of mind, it's going a bit into the theory, but what I mean is, there's one that is, also called hell, the hell realms. Mm. And, you get these pictures of, you know, the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Mm. No, sorry, the Tibetan Wheel of Life. Mm. And in all of those six realms, you have a particular figure. Sometimes it's a Buddha figure. Sometimes it's, what we call a bodhisattva sort of helping figure, like Avalokiteshvara. And they bring, you know, the medicine, the cure to all of these six realms. Mm. And in the hell realm, it is Amrita. It is the nectar.
Yeah.
So, and then Sangharakshita, what he commented was that, first of all, it's something to reflect on, but, you know, maybe because if you're in that kind of state of mental suffering, the only thing you can take, the only thing that will help at that point is just enlightenment.
That's true.
Do you know what it is? So I'd never what does that mean?
I don't know what that means, but I remember when I used to live in Bristol, and I don't know what kind of state of mind I was in. I was obviously a bit stressed, but I used to think, I wish there was some kind of like spiritual heroin or some nice spiritual codeine where you can just get, you know, it's not a natural drug, but you just go, everything's okay.
Yeah.
All the pain's gone, all the stress is gone. And you do get that on retreat sometimes, don't you? You know, when you're meditating or anywhere actually, where you know, there's something positive going on and you just feel the weight fall off you. Mm. Oh, it's such a relief. Mm. Oh, it's amazing. And there's no come down either.
No. I was just thinking, I don't think I've been in hell realms too often, but when I've been quite low or depressed or something, then sometimes, you know, you try out different things to kind of come out of a negative mental state again. Yeah. And then sometimes you're just like, oh, of course, the Dharma. It's easy, isn't it?
It's always the last one though, isn't it? Try chocolate, try Netflix.
Dharma. Like meditating, studying, you know, good friends, friendship. So maybe it points to that as well. Well, apparently mindfulness as well.
I mean, I think it happens to everybody though, doesn't it? I remember a friend of mine, I won't say who, but a friend of mine in Padmaloka was walking around with this individual and and they were like, oh, this, nothing's working, blah, blah, blah. And he just turned around and said, have you tried the Dharma? Yeah. So it's just like...
Apparently it was an automatic as well. Yeah.
So we forget, don't we? It's just like we just... Because it's... I don't know what... I think it is this thing. It's discontinuous with our regular state of mind. We're looking for a solution on its own level. And you can't find one, can you? You've got worldly problems. You look for... I mean, I hate talking like that. But anyway, then you've got quote-unquote worldly solutions. but they don't really work in the right way.
Mm.
Yeah. Anyway.
No, it's just mindfulness in the end. I mean, mindfulness is the path to the deathless. Yeah. And I guess, like, in all its aspects, that's where that points. Like, but maybe we can go on with the quote to see.
Yeah, just read the rest. I mean, well, we've just talked about mindfulness is the way to the immortal, and then goes on to say, unmindfulness is the way to death.
Hmm. Unmindfulness is the way to death. I don't know. For me, on my kind of meager level of understanding, I think it, for me, when I hear that, it's like before, the if you're just crashing through life, you just end up in a box, in a state of fear. You've got all this unnecessary drama going on with people, and death looms large. You know, you're clinging onto yourself. You get more contracted, isn't it? And then at the same, when you're more contracted, you're more scared.
Mm.
And then death gets bigger in your mind because it's the end of me. Because me, I'm so important. And actually, you just suffer a lot.
Mm.
And maybe it's also on a more, not on the level of just the death and the drama and all that, but just not being aware and living a life where you just superimpose all your concepts and ideas and you don't really have any experience. I think, what kind of life is that?
That's interesting,
if you just don't, if you don't participate in life, if you're not breathing,
that's a good point.
And if you're not, if there's no interaction, I think it's just a life that's lived in your head and your intellectual
stories
and whatever. Yeah. But that's for me is a dead life in a sense because you're not in contact with any kind of real experience and real vibration.
I think that's the whole superimposing. I mean, that's, I guess, like you just said, if you're not superimposing, then you've got you're alive. Actually, you're fully alive. But the whole, it's that whole superimposing thing, isn't it? Which is what mindfulness kind of deals with on that level, at least. You know, you just know you're superimposing. I mean, it's a weird experience, isn't it? It's like when you, I had it over the winter retreat just gone. Like, I, you know, you're meditating, and all of a sudden, whether you're in meditation or out, you're suddenly aware of, not exactly, but kind of what you're thinking, what you're feeling. And then you get a sense, oh, I'm actually generating this. Yeah, this is me. I'm doing this. The current, my current state, my current emotional state is because of me. Mm. It's not the world coming in and poking me. It's like, oh, yeah. And then me, it's the world. And then it just goes. And then I'm back in the state of reactivity and, oh, it's them, they're bastards, and it's this whole state. And it's like, oh, right, there's a kind of shift. They're kind of, when you're in that state of mindfulness, you do feel more alive, actually. And you feel like you're, I don't know about in the driving seat, but you're certainly not just the whim of all these kind of reactions and negative emotions. Mm. And when you're not in there, you're kind of vulnerable. And I don't mean in a good way. I mean, you're kind of like a bit, you know.
Mm.
Yeah, I've always felt that Buddhism or Buddhist practice is more, well, really a celebration of life, but not in a hedonistic way, obviously, of just, you know,
partially maybe,
mindful of, you know, all the hedonistic pleasures you have, but more of a life of meaning and of, well, as you say, participation of life. We do say, you know, there is dissatisfactoriness in life or suffering or whatever you might call it, but because of that, we are able, or we want to celebrate life more fully because we're aware of its shortcomings as well. And then we, you know, and because we take ourselves seriously. Well, that's always how I felt when I, you know, well, when I asked for ordination or when I was wanted to become a Buddhist, I just thought, well, my life is so important to me.
Yeah.
I really want to make the most out of it and not just kind of throw it away in a continuous stream of, madness, depression, you know, concepts, headiness.
And also, like, the ability to open up to others and to kind of take in others and practice compassion or just connect, the feeling of really being in interaction with others. I think that is also something that's only possible if you kind of be present somehow, and if you can be present in the moment and in what's really life in the connection. Otherwise, it's also going to be quite painful if we kind of live relationships with just our kind of the dragging or the wanting from the other person. So
I'll just read the last two lines and then maybe we can move on. Those who are mindful do not die, whereas the unmindful are like the dead.
Well, we kind of said that.
Yeah.
We said that already.
I just love it. It's like, those who are mindful do not die, whereas the unmindful are like the dead. And then some translations says are already dead.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a strong language with death and life.
Yeah.
So you kind of were talking about death, immortality, and then mindfulness somewhere in the middle. So that's, I always found this kind of just, you know, the poles that we have here.
You know what, though? I think it's really important, this whole paragraph, because I know it kind of goes against the culture, the time that we're living in, but more and more I just want to get away from mindfulness as a kind of, I don't know, technique or dry, as if it's just neat and tidy and it will improve your life a bit. And, you know, I think mindfulness is, listening to that, it gives you a sense of, it's really powerful language. And it's actually, when you really step into it, that's what it feels like. It's not just, it's got a kind of magical quality to it. It's not just being a bit more sane, which is a nice start, isn't it, actually, all being said, but it's got a kind of power to it, actually.
It's interesting that you say that, because I always wondered, like, for me, I think without something that was somehow pulling me, or this kind of magic, mysterious kind of quality, which I think is the image of the deathless or Amrita or whatever, I would have never been able to kind of practice mindfulness. Yeah. And I always wonder, how do people
really boring.
Do that if they have just the idea of kind of optimizing themselves or getting a better me or whatever.
Well, that's,
all the kind of secular mindfulness. I think it really needs something that is so much beyond. I at least needed that. Otherwise, I wouldn't have said that.
I think when I used to think of, especially monks, you know, no disrespect to any monks out there in the orange robes, and this is my complete misconception, maybe, but I used to just think they're like robots, and I just thought, I don't want to be a Buddhist robot where I'm really mindful and clever and, you know, just sensitive. And
I had that the other day. Slowly.
Yeah, I just thought, what's the point? I don't care. You know, it's just like, I'm not going to spend all my energy in life just becoming more sensible and more kind of, how to say, just more kind of aware of how I'm drinking a cup of tea. It's just not good enough. I'm not giving my life to that. But then recently I just felt like, in a way, there's a lot more going on, and mindfulness is a sort of magic. You're sort of protecting something else, you know, by being mindful. You're protecting some kind of I just keep saying it, magic, I like that word, but there's something going on. And when you're mindful, it protects that. I just thought, I'm not going to spend my life being mindful for the sake of being mindful. You know, I want to actually be alive.
That's not good enough.
I'm sure mindful people are alive. But hopefully I'm more mindful. Yeah. But I mean,
people who are like the dead because they're too mindful.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like an image, isn't it? It's like a Buddhist image. Like, people think Buddhists are like sort of drab, dry, you know, now I'll mindfully wash up and I'll mindfully walk. You think, who wants that?
Get nothing done.
Who wants to be like
probably
that?
Probably a strange idea of mindfulness as well.
It's horrible.
Good. Glad we clarified that.
I've got loads of big opinions because I know everything.
Well, do you want to go next then with your quote, or do you?
I have one that would fit probably.
Good. Yeah. Well, then go.
I don't know. If you
save us. No, you go.
Okay. Save us.
Save me anyway.
So I did bring a small teaching from Sangharakshita, and it's from a list of things that he recommended for people who don't, but basically he said, you can work directly on your mind by meditating.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, if you're not a meditator as a person, or just to support your meditation, there are other things that might also work to raise your level of consciousness.
Yeah.
And one thing he recommends, and I thought that's something that would be interesting to discuss with you, is one point, and I read it first and then we can go into it. So, then there is the leading of a regular and disciplined life, something which apparently is becoming less and less popular. This may consist in the observance of certain moral precepts and principles, in having regular hours for meals, for work, for recreation, and for study, or in observing moderation in such things as eating, sleeping, and talking, perhaps even fasting occasionally, or observing silence for a few days or weeks. In its fully developed form, this more regular, disciplined life is what we call the monastic life. Among those who are leading such a regular, disciplined life, even without any meditation, over a period of years, one can see quite clearly a change taking place in their state of consciousness.
Very good. I would concur. Well, probably because I got it from Sangharakshita.
Yeah. Yeah, so I thought it's interesting. It's just an interesting fact because I noticed that something in me really is really wants a more regular life, and is resonating with that. And then I think the conditions we live in make it often so difficult to kind of put that into place. And I really feel like it's something that's not very popular, and it's not very easy in the kind of situation we live in to create a more regular life. But I mean, I can really feel like just coming from a 1 week meditation retreat with structure, I mean, how beneficial it is if you really kind of know what you're doing and if you have fixed times for eating and you have the space and I mean, it's something that's quite impressive in the effect it has.
I mean, I'm all
states of mind,
all for the monastic model. I think that, you know, when I was first on retreat, I think I loved it because not so much because I was interested in meditation, but because it had a sort of monastic kind of outlet. You know, you had to wake up at a certain time, meditation, then meals. I'm really wondering how I can, or how we can, as a community, kind of bring that more into our daily life, because it is quite difficult when you're in the city, I think, to have that structure. But I would love to kind of develop more of, maybe longer retreats or something, or just sort of situations where we can just all come together and live a life that looks like that. You know, because I mean, I've always been quite fascinated by monasteries, both the European monastery tradition, and then also the Japanese one, but Chinese. You know, I kind of always imagine myself kind of, you know, you work on a field and there's a bell ringing and you're like, okay, prayer time and then meal or something. I just love that image. Also because it shows the conditions you need for raising your consciousness.
And your mindfulness.
And your mindfulness. because sometimes, you know, well, as you said, if you're not a meditator, or if meditation doesn't come naturally to you, then you can get quite frustrated with the practice of meditation. You think, through meditation, I need to become more mindful. Whereas I've come to think, well, no, you need to bring yourself in a context where there's already a level of mindfulness going on. And then when you sit down to meditate, you can just kind of dwell in that space, and that will, you can just kind of be dragged into meditation by meditation itself.
That is a clear, I mean, it clearly shows also like how easy it sometimes is if you go, if you're on retreat, to kind of reach different level of meditation. I mean, how much those conditions really help to kind of suddenly bring about an experience that would never be possible under normal daily life conditions.
Or even if you have a bad meditation on retreat, I always then comfort myself by saying, well, but I have been, you know, I have lived in, you know, through a week or through 2 weeks of, well, not being in too bad conditions. I mean, that has effect on my mind as well. Even if I struggle with meditation, there's always a reason for it. But even that is a value in itself, to live a life like that, I think.
I was thinking, because I think you can work another depth in a way, because you've got a kind of continuity. It's like there's also a continuity of purpose, isn't it? If you've got a habitual life that's structured with, even with rituals, whatever, you kind of know there's a constant reminder. And also, it's like, instead of just living day to day, you kind of end up living, I don't know, week to week in a way. You've got a whole sense of the rhythm of it. It's not just sporadic. 1 minute you're really high with your friends, and then you kind of crash, and then you kind of get up at 10, then you get up at 3, and then, you know, there's no, you can't really gauge what's going on. Mm. It's very, well, talking about mindfulness, very difficult to know what's actually going on. But if you've got a kind of a steady kind of rhythm to things, you can get a much clearer sense of what's, yeah, in terms of mindfulness, especially what's going on with you and what's going on. You know, you get a sense of those subtle energies that normally get lost when you have all kind of stuff going on. And I guess in a way, then you get your juice, so to speak, or your spontaneity within meditation, then, or within that context. It's not just like boring kind of life. You actually get, I think you can actually end up with a depth when you've got a regular, routine. It's interesting though, because apparently, like, wherever Sangharakshita went, he'd set up a routine, wouldn't he? Like,
yeah.
Even if he was somewhere for a week, he'd like, okay, so it's going to be like this, dum, dum, dum. And in a way, then you can just forget about it, takes care of itself, and you can devote your mind to the important things rather than kind of scattered around trying to piece your life together, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I do find that personally really inspiring, but at the same time, I feel it's quite difficult to kind of really bring it into, I mean, in... not on retreat conditions, but like in the daily life, like how I noticed that, like, the pull to kind of give in to, I don't know, meetings, whatever, or all sorts of things. It's
a mystery.
It's
a kind of life's work though, isn't it? I was thinking about that recently, probably because of these online retreats. I kind of thought, yeah, this whole schizophrenic spiritual life where, you know, most of the year we're running around like headless chickens, and then for a few weeks we act like we're in a kind of monastic or setting. It's not that beneficial in a way. Somehow you've got to kind of figure out how to, well, it relates to our whole order, the whole ordination thing about it not being a lay order, and yet we're not a monastic order either, but we're definitely not a lay order. I think that's the thing. It's not like you just kind of hang out a bit and then live a worldly life. I hate saying that word. Why do I keep saying it? There's no other word. Anyway, you live a life, and then you go and be all spiritual and be like a nun or a monk for a couple of weeks, and you come back into the chaos, and it's like, that's not really good enough. You're not really gonna, and therefore it's really difficult, because I think that's what happens, isn't it? You get involved, and then your whole life is called into question, all your routines, your patterns. And if you're not into that, that's fine. It's time to bail, you know what I mean? And just try and keep it as something nice in your life, as a little hobby. But otherwise it starts becoming pretty intense, you know, like, how am I? It's like, wow, I really want to do this, but that means I'm going to have to change my whole life, actually, you know, like my whole life.
Yeah, but I was just thinking that with... those online retreats, somehow there is something quite beneficial in just creating retreat conditions in your own environment.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. Exactly.
Home, yeah,
that's what I mean.
Like, and trying to bring that space closer together. So
yeah, I'm sure we can do it, though, you know, because I think the thing is, it's been demonstrated that we can do it. And it's a bit like you were saying, I think it is possible then. And we've seen it's possible in this sort of extraordinary sort of, I don't know how you say, time in a way, where we're doing online retreats, and the time that you would normally take out, you're doing it at home, and then you might even meet your regular friends in the same city and go for a walk with them. So it shows we can do it. It's just like, we just didn't, I think most of us probably don't even think it, haven't even thought in those terms. You know, you just get into a pattern of practice where you're just doing your work, blah, 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 blah. And then, oh, now I'm on retreat and now I'm working. And we've done it for decades, and fair enough. But it seems like, oh, right, maybe we can actually do, I think we need to do it differently. Mm. We have to, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's a matter of, also living a life where you can actually, where you create the conditions that you actually end up going on retreat as well.
Yeah.
Because I can, you know, I see that in people who, you know, even auto members who then kind of, live just very full lives, and then retreats sort of get overlooked as well. So to sort of, you know, to let the barrier between a retreat and everyday life kind of be thinner and thinner.
Well, that's what I think. That's the goal, though, isn't it? Because otherwise, you know, I think if your regular life is more, I don't know, practice orientated, and you've got a kind of regular life, then when you go on retreat, you'll go much more deep, much more quick, and also you probably come out of the retreat better. You won't just come out like fired out of a cannon, you know, back into the city or kind of disorientated for 3 days, like, oh, where am I, what am I supposed to be doing, and you know, it'd just be like, oh, right, I just went a bit deeper, now I'm back in,
Yeah, yeah, like this transitions get smoother. Yeah, and I think that's really the work also to kind of bring that state of mind to your normal conditions. And I thought it was quite interesting. A woman in my group on the retreat last week, she was really, really amazed that she discovered that she could have states of mind that she connected with a certain specific place, the retreat center, in her own home conditions. And she has three children, and she practiced within her family situation, but she suddenly realized, oh, it's not bound to a specific place. I can develop those states of mind in my conditions. And I think that's really as magic and it really important that people kind of realize that.
I mean, it's up to you to create a faculty of creating conditions. I think that's why solitaries are so important. I mean, as order members, you're supposed to go on a month-long solitary every year. And I hope I will be there eventually. But I think when I'm on solitary, I think the main thing really is, you know, I think it's about, you know, or meditating a lot or something, but actually it's about creating, well, a schedule, you know, maybe a daily program or not, or just like really knowing in what kind of conditions you need to be in. You know, when to eat, when to
maintain positive states of mind. What kind of conditions do you need?
To be frankly, though, my solitaries have just showed me that I need to sort my life out. I turn up on a solitary, like I'm going to have an amazing solitary, and then I sit there. Actually, I just want to sleep for 3 days, and then I need all these thoughts that I haven't had a chance to think about. Actually, this is just telling me I need to sort the rest of my life out, so that when I do go on a solitary, then I'm actually looking forward to meditate. Like, you know, because you haven't caught up with yourself. Which is crazy.
You just feel, well, not everyone, but I do feel like a wrecking ball at first. For the first 7 days or something, because you're trying to figure yourself out.
Exactly. You know, because there's things you need, isn't there? There's things you need to think about. Do you actually need some rest, maybe? So I figured, I feel like the goal over the past year or so, maybe a bit longer, has just become clear. It's like I want to live a life in a city where I'm actually meditating and practicing at a level that I'm satisfied with. But it's hard work. It's not easy.
And I think it's probably the most challenging thing. But this is also what I feel really inspired by, is to kind of not withdraw to the countryside somewhere and to some kind of rock, silent rock somewhere to sit there and meditate, but to kind of bring that into the city and where people are, because I think that's really where we need to be.
I mean, that said, though, I think you'd have to be a pretty unique person. The more I go on, the more I think you'd have to be a pretty unique person to go and live in a cave and withdraw from the city and successfully do that for 20 years. You know, I don't know if I've met anyone that can do that. I think it's like, if I went and did that, I'd be like dreaming about Mars bars after a week and like,
fried Mars bars.
No, it's true. I mean, it's true. And I think it's probably for some people that is the way to practice. Yeah. But I also feel like...
No, you're right.
I feel quite inspired to kind of try and find a way that is living the Dharma and finding a way to enlightenment, but within the conditions where people live in the 21st century.
And it can be done. I mean, it can be done, can't it? It's just, I think it's just a case of intensity of practice and really, really getting away from this notion that we're somehow a lay order. Because even order members, a lot of, you know, it's like we give lip service to the idea. You know, we do. I do. I'm like kind of, oh yeah, we're not monastic, but we're not lay. And then it's like, well, I'm pretty lay at the moment. I don't mean right now, but I just mean sometimes.
And I think, if you look at your whole...
You need to, I think that's it. Maybe then you need a group of people that you really enjoy practicing with, and there's a certain level of intensity and heat to it. And it's like, all right, I'm actually on this. You know, it's not just, I'm not just waiting for the retreat. I'm actually trying to get this going. It's difficult, but...
But in the city, I think, I mean, this is why I think this project of our Buddhist center here is so important. Oh,
it's a miracle, this place, man.
Because I think this is the only place where something could happen like that. I think a community is important to bring that about. I think it would be, if I lived on my own, I think it would be quite difficult to create that just by myself. But you know, to look at a place like that and really make it a space.
This place is a miracle.
Of those conditions. So I think I'm looking forward for us to transforming it more and more into sort of temple or whatever, just a place, that has a sort of spiritual weight within the city.
I felt the other day, I just felt so grateful for all the people that had managed to, I don't know, do what needed to be done to buy this place, to make it, to build it, to do that. I thought, this is extraordinary. It really is, you know. I mean, you walk into this place and it's just like, if you don't know, it's just like, oh. But then you start realizing how it came about. And it's just the beginning as well. I think that's the thing. It's extraordinary, isn't it? You've got this amazing opportunity now in the middle of Berlin to actually start generating, start generating something, you know.
Yeah, but I also feel like it's really having that at the center and then creating opportunities for people to live together and for just being more together. I guess that's also really helpful to not having to kind of set up structures on your own. So I definitely feel like it's great to live with other women who practice, and we kind of have a shared time in the morning to meditate together, and that creates a structure and a little bit of discipline. I mean, it's still difficult, I find, to kind of, because I guess it takes a lot of self-discipline also to kind of really know what you want to do. And I think if it's Dharma study or something that's more like inner practice, I feel like sometimes there is this kind of balance of the wish to kind of be with others and communicate. But then also you need the time and you need the solitary time in order to look at things. And so I that's also, I mean, that's a conundrum of the spiritual life as well. I find like kind of finding a really workable balance of those two things.
I think within the, you know, I think I find it quite helpful that, you know, the whole, like you're saying about establishing a routine. So it's like you've got a regular life where, you get up at the same time, you eat, and then you can put your mind to the big things. But then now and then having those, I don't know, like festival days or like pujas, like at night, or, you know, just where you step into another, that other, so you don't end up just being like a
robot.
You have these kind of wild times. You might even be on a solitary and it goes a bit, it does go a bit wild sometimes, doesn't it? It's certainly your dream life, that's for sure. And you know, rituals and all this kind of stuff.
And you need to be open to what's really needed, actually. I mean, it's also, I think it requires a good knowledge of yourself to kind of know what works, because structures can also, if you just go with the structure, not be what you need. You might get trapped into something.
You'll be intuitive, don't you?
I found that
myself, like recently, in recent, I don't know, past couple of years in a way, it's like, I mean, it sounds like a bit of a cop-out, but I just sort of say, well, what do you actually want to do? Not what you should do to be a good Buddhist, what do you actually want to do? And then really look at that and think, oh, actually, no, I don't want to do that now, but I like to do it this way, and what would be nice? And, you know, so treating yourself in a kind of, in a good way and enjoying what you're doing, and at the same time having a real, I don't know, like being present for yourself, so you know when you're drifting off into the wilderness or when you're just, like, distracting yourself. But at the same time, you've got to kind of, well, the whole Eros thing, finding what you actually want to do and making that work. Well, that said, though, I have to say, when I lived at Padmaloka, which was a semi-monastic community, my meditation wasn't so great a lot of the time, but that structure, it changed my life, completely changed my life. Before that, I could never get out of bed to meditate. It was like, I was like, oh my God, if I live here, I'm going to have to meditate every day at 7, every day. And I was just like, and I'm going to have to study. But it was amazing. It wasn't even me. It changed me completely, because I couldn't quite get my act together beforehand. And just being in the process of having that kind of structure on a daily basis over a few years, it sort of shaped something.
I think those two things go together, because if you have a structure that you can rely on, I think a structure gives you a space to think about, well, what do I want to do actually? Because otherwise you just kind of, I don't know, well, I feel like I'm in a sort of train that's going somewhere, but I don't know where it's going. You're trying this, you're trying that, it's not really going anywhere. But if you have that structure, then that opens up something. We're like, oh no, actually, we can actually be more in touch with your intuition as well. Yeah. I think it's quite important to be in touch with your intuition, and even, you know, things here in the center, or like Buddhist things, like you, sometimes you're like, sometimes you get that feeling, I don't know, when a meditation is taught, or I don't know, the way we're doing things here. Sometimes you get that feeling of, I hear the words and they're correct, but it doesn't quite feel right. There's something not right about it. Why is it? Why do I not want to do it? Why am I bored? Let's look into that. But I think that can only come out of you having committed to a structure, or you having committed to, and then creativity can come from the friction in a way with the structure as well.
Definitely, because I mean, and I think that's something that I feel in general society, there is the kind of idea that creativity comes out of this chaos and openness and whatever.
Yeah, in the movies.
I mean, just feeling movies, yourself.
And, like, oh. And I mean, I had that idea for a long time. And I think, I mean, and I thought in order to work in the creative area, you need just to kind of get up when you want and whatever. And just, I don't know, go to parties or whatever. But it's really, I mean, and only when I started to change my life to a more regular routine, I noticed what kind of...
Yeah, it's mad.
It's mad.
It's mad. Do you know what?
We're not, because there's so many, and you lose so much energy in just deciding, because you're like, if you don't have a time when you get up, you wake up and you think, do I want to get up or do I want to stay in bed?
Yeah. It's already a lot of willpower involved.
Exactly.
You need so much time to kind of make up your mind and take a decision. And then there's no space for creativity left.
You were talking about meditation. It was the same for me, because Singarava and I, we founded a community together. It was only at that point when I started meditating every day, because I knew there were other people doing it as well. So living together was, you know, was such a great... I actually watched a video, I think it was yesterday, where they talked about the same thing about willpower. And apparently, so there's, you know, every day you only have a certain amount of willpower or something. And then it goes, you know, even if you're just procrastinating, and even, you know, all those choices, or do I watch that video? Do I watch that video now? Or do I do Facebook? That already takes, you know, reduces your willpower for the day. So when you then want to do... I don't know, a big task of work, you already have exhausted the willpower. So they were doing these studies with students, apparently. It was quite funny. And they thought, the hypothesis was that students who handed in their assignments in time would also wear clean socks, so they could also, you know, they were the organized ones. But apparently it was the other way around. It was they could either hand in their assignments, you know, in time and do it neatly and finally, or they could wear clean socks, i.e. do their laundry, because they only had so much willpower. So it wasn't a matter of,
this is good being organized
and being organized or not being organized. But it was like, well, because they needed, well, they were living in a student home, so they needed to go down to the laundry room and then stay there for 2 hours. So it was a big deal to do the laundry. So, and then they didn't have energy to do the assignment.
But I really, I mean, I really think that our current situation and the society just overwhelms us with the number of decisions that we need to take.
Making and so many micro decisions every day.
It is crazy.
And I perfectly imagine that this consumes all the willpower that you have, and that you're really, because there's too many things like, what do I buy here or there, and which brand of shampoo do I take or whatever. If you really want to go into more profound things,
there's no energy
left. So, and I think also this is probably something that's interesting, like also reducing the choice of what you buy. I mean, in the community, we've started to buy stuff bulk, like what do you say, like from a
wholesale.
And so so certain basic things we just buy and we reorder. So and I feel it's such a relief to not having to go to the supermarket and to kind of think about what do we want or whatever.
What kind of nuts do you want?
And I think this is really also a key to contentment in a way, like having a more a simpler life with less decisions is really the way forward. If we want to
feel
some kind of contentment.
I had a friend in London. She's from Slovakia. I think she grew up just towards the end of communism. And we were walking through London, like central Oxford Street. And she was saying when she grew up, there was like every year there was something like five trousers released. At the start of the year, you get five different stars you could have. And if you wanted to change them, you had to sew things on yourself and do stuff. But that was it, five. And we were walking through Oxford Street and there must have been like, I mean, hundreds of thousands of different types of jeans and stars. And it's like, you need apps these days. You need specialists. You need PhD in
YouTube
fashion.
Videos.
Just a YouTube video, 10 YouTube videos just to buy a pair of jeans. It's like, wow, this is taking up a lot of mental and emotional. I'm not advocating for communism, by the way, but just like, it takes up a lot of mental and emotional energy, actually. All these tiny little, Maitre Bandhu's good on that, isn't it? He's like, do you want to live a trivial life? It's like the tragedy of our age in a way is for us in this part of the world, generally a lot of the time it's trivia. It's like you could have lived, you live a certain life and you end up living a trivial life just by the nature of the way we do things here in a way. I mean, here, in Buddhist dishes too, I just mean in the wider society. You end up with trivia.
So, I think we've talked an hour now.
An hour?
Yeah.
All right.
Do you want to read your quote just so we know what you brought? Or
okay.
It's probably provocative again.
What? Let's see.
Just say it. Come on.
I don't know. It's going to be a long one.
You can cut it out.
No, we're not cutting it out.
No.
You don't edit this show. This show is unedited.
Okay, so we want to hear it.
All right.
We just take it for reflection.
Have a long beep of it.
In meditation, as we go deeper and deeper, we often experience a great fear. Sometimes people shy away from this fear, but it is good to allow oneself to experience it. That fear occurs when we feel what may be called a touch of shunyata, the touch of reality on the conditioned self. And the touch of reality on the conditioned self feels like a death. It is death for the conditioned self. So the conditioned self feels afraid. Shall we read that again?
Mm-hmm.
That's good, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It relates
to perfectly.
It fits perfectly with the beginning as well.
In meditation, as we go deeper and deeper, we often experience a great fear. Sometimes people shy away from this fear, but it is good to allow oneself to experience it. That fear occurs when we feel what may be called the touch of shunyata, the touch of reality on the conditioned self. And the touch of reality on the conditioned self feels like a death. It is death for the conditioned self, so the conditioned self feels afraid. That's from a lecture on the system of meditation.
Oh, I love that. I think it's perfect. I mean, I think I've talked about that in the podcast before, but I've definitely felt that kind of fear because I was trying to bypass absorption, you know, like just integration, you know, like because first of all you need to gather your mind and then you can move on. But I always tried, okay, I've done that, now I needed to do an insight practice. I think I did that in Gusha Loka, and then something vast came into my consciousness, and I thought, like just this fear came up, and you thought, I'm actually not ready for that at all. Like when you're trying to, I think for me it was more trying to see a Buddha or see a Bodhisattva. That's how I phrased it, you know, the touch of shunyata, the touch of voidness. But you can phrase it in those words as well. But then when you see it, when you meet it, it's so frightening because you're not ready, because it would mean, because in a way it is a death.
Well, it is
not literal death, but a death, it feels literally like a literal death. It does feel it is stronger literally than
It's the abyss that you reach in meditation at some point, and you think, okay, am I going further? Am I allowing myself to just let go into that unknown?
So a touch of shunyata.
No, I really, I think that's a big part of it, isn't it? Because I think most of the time I feel like I'm trying to, I was saying this the other day, on one hand, I feel like I'm trying to open a door. And literally at the same time, I've got my foot against the door. It's a strange tension. It's like, I don't want to open the door. And at the same time, that's what I've put my whole life to, is opening this door. And I'm, so you're in a state of kind of a, Well, it's quite tricky sometimes, isn't it?
Mm.
But anyway, yeah, and no, I really, when I read that, I thought, oh yeah, that's something, isn't it?
Mm.
And I guess if you're going to do this, you have to be prepared in a way. I think Sangharakshita to himself said he had like 2 years of just perpetual fear when he was quite young. And it's like, I think if you're going to do this, you have to be, you have to get used to fear actually, which is, for me, it's been quite difficult.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you just got, when you get, especially on a solitary retreat, for example, you get the terrors or whatever, and you just sort of say, all right, this is part of it. And it's not like you're not going to feel it. You are going to feel it. But I got my, you know, like I said, when I was doing, went on a solitary and had this puja, and it's like, magic puja. Yeah. I looked out the window, there's a sunset, there's like some water, and I was just like, there are different realms of existence, yeah? Mm-hmm. And I was just in a higher realm, and I was like, oh, at last. And then I came out my door, got to this lake. Actually, there was a swan with some baby swans, yeah? And I thought, oh, beautiful baby swans, yeah. And then mummy swan, like, started, or dad, I don't know, I can't tell, I'm afraid, which, whatever it was, came towards me. And then it started putting his wings out to the side and hissing and put his neck back. And I was like, shit, I got totally terrified. It was ridiculous, like, do you know what I mean? Fully grown adult. And I ran away from the swan back to my heart.
That can be very...
Yeah, but I don't think, anyway, I got back to my heart and locked the door. Yeah? Oh, it's I don't think swans can kick in doors. And I was, like, lying on the floor for 10 minutes. And I said, when I got back to London, I asked my friend Jananand, and he was saying, well, in a way, you don't choose which direction you open. Yeah, it's just like, you don't just choose to enter the God realm because you've done loads of meditation, you had a beautiful puja, and now you see the truth because it's all up there. It's like, if you're going to open that way, you're also going to open at the other end, to use that metaphor.
Yeah.
And you're going to experience the terror as well. Mm. It's just like, this is how it is. Mm. And I found that really helpful.
That's integration in all directions.
Yeah.
It's also like integrating, of course, all the darkness. Yeah. And
but it probably shows you how much of it, I think, to do with the whole terror thing, it probably shows you how much of a quote-unquote self that you actually have. Because you've got all sorts of ideas about yourself, and then you get the terrors, and it's like, oh yeah, I've definitely got a me. There's definitely an I here, you know, this sort of contracted self that, you know, there's all this fear.
Yeah. I mean, I also remember quite well when I had that realization, like, I think that was after my Mitra ceremony, which was quite strong as a ritual. And I had a period of intense joy.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly I got all these images in my mind that were really frightening. And I think in that, and then I really realized, and I thought, oh, this is a spiritual path. This is what I kind of signed up for. So, and I realized this is—it's a lot of self-confrontation. Mm. It's not going to be easy or pleasant or whatever. Mm. It's going to be existential in some bits. So, but it was quite a profound moment, and I really thought, okay, this is it. Yeah. Okay.
This is sometimes what goes through our mind when we teach newcomers meditation classes, like, you know, we talk like, oh, you can calm down and you can have positive feelings. Sometimes I think, oh, we're
bad people, aren't we?
Well, no, like, what are we teaching actually? Exactly. You know, like when you're starting to teach someone meditation, you sometimes think, what are we actually?
Yeah.
Actually, we have to put in a warning at first and say, well, actually, you're gonna, you know, if you're really serious about this, you will.
But it doesn't
end up changing your life a lot.
The warning is just more appealing.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, oh, don't do this because this is like really dangerous and difficult. And you're like, whatever.
Maybe you should say that
a
bit more.
It won't be the same. But.
All right.
Good. That was great.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah,
the immortal,
thank you.
The touch of fear.
The nectar of the deathless.
Yeah.
The amrita.
Yeah. So. Discipline.
Yeah.
Discipline, everything. Well, now you know what to do.
Yeah. Great.
Well, thanks very much, and I hope this year will be good.
It will be a good one.
Promising one.
Yeah, great.
See you soon.
Thank you. See you later.
See you soon.
Bye.
Bye.